Chapter 8. The academy not only by a body servant, but by a private governor or pedant, whose business it was to overlook his studies, attend him abroad, and have an eye to the society he frequented. The old Marquess of Donnez had sent his daughter, by Odo's hand, a letter recommending her to select her son's governor with particular care, choosing rather a person of grave behavior and assured morality than one of your glibbing spatterers who may know the inside of all the folios in the king's library without being the better qualified for the direction of a young gentleman's conduct. And to this letter Don Gervaso appended the terse postscript: Your Excellency is especially warned against according this, or any other position of trust to the Merry Andrew who calls himself the Abate Cantapresto. Donna Laura, with a shrug, handed the letter to her husband. Count Valdu, adjusting his glasses, observed it was notorious that people living in the depths of the country thought themselves qualified to instruct their city relatives on all points connected with the social usages, and the Cicisbeo suggested that he could recommend an abate who was proficient in the construction of the Martellian verse, and who would make no extra charge for that accomplishment. Charges, the Countess cried. There's a matter my father doesn't deign to consider. It's not enough, nowadays, to give the lads a governor, but they must maintain their servants to an idle gluttonous crew that prey on their pockets and get a commission off every tradesman's bill. Count Valdu lifted a deprecating hand. My dear, nothing could be more offensive to His Majesty than any attempt to reduce the way of living of the pupils of the academy. Of course, she shrugged, a tooth to pay? The Duke's beggarly pittance hardly clothes him. The Cicisbeo suggested that the Cavalier Odo had expectations, at which Donna Laura flushed and turned uneasy, while the Count, part of whose marital duty it was to intervene discreetly between his lady and her knight, now put forth the remark that the Abate Cantapresto seemed a shrewd, serviceable fellow. Nor do I like to turn him adrift, cried the Countess instantly, after he has obliged us by attending my son on his journey. And I understand, added the Count, that he would be glad to serve the Cavalier in any capacity you might designate. Why not in all? Said the Cicisbeo thoughtfully. There would be undoubted advantages to the Cavalier in possessing a servant who would explain the globes, while powdering his hair, and not be above calling his chair when he attended him to a lecture. And the upshot of it was that when Odo, a few days later, entered on his first term at the academy, he was accompanied by the Abate Cantapresto, who had agreed, for a minimum of pay, to serve him faithfully in the double capacity of pedagogue and lackey. The considerable liberty accorded the foreign students made Odo's first year at the academy at once pleasanter and less profitable than had he been one of the regular pupils. The companions among whom he found himself were a set of lively, undisciplined young gentlemen, chiefly from England, Russia, and the German principalities, all in possession of more or less pocket money, and attended by governors either pedantic and self-engrossed or vulgarly subservient. These young sprigs, whose ambition it was to ape the dress and manners of the royal pages, led a life of dissipation barely interrupted by a few hours of attendance at the academic classes. From the ill effects of such surroundings, Odo was preserved by an intellectual curiosity that flung him ravening on his studies. It was not that he was of a bookish habit, or that the drudgery of the classes was less irksome to him than to the other pupils, but not even the pedantic methods then prevailing, or the distractions of his new life, could dull the flush of his first encounter with the past. His imagination took fire over the dry pages of Cornelius Nepos, glowed with the mild pastoral warmth of the Georgics, and burst into flame at the first hexameters of the Aeneid. He caught but a fragment of meaning here and there, but the sumptuous imagery, the stirring names, the glimpses into a past where Roman senators were mingled with the gods of a gold-pillared Olympus, filled his mind with a misty pageant of immortals. These moments of high emotion were interspersed with hours of plodding over the Latin grammar and the textbooks of philosophy and logic. Books were a known ground to Canto Presto, and among masters and pupils there was not one who could help Odo to the meaning of his task, or who seemed aware that it might have a meaning. To most of the lads about him, the purpose of the academy was to fit young gentlemen for the army or the court, to give them the chance of sweating a shirt every morning with the fencing master, and of learning to thread the intricacies of the court minuet. They modeled themselves on the dress and bearing of the pages, who were always ruffling it about the quadrangle in court dress and sword, or booted and spurred for a day's hunting at the king's chase of Stupinigi. To receive a nod or a word from one of these young demigods on his way to the king's opera box, or just back from a pleasure party at Her Majesty's villa above the Po, to hear of their tremendous exploits and thrilling escapades seemed to put the whole school in touch with the fine gentleman's world of intrigue, cards and dueling. The world in which ladies were subjugated, fortunes lost, adversaries run through and tradesmen ruined with that imperturbable grace which distinguished the man of quality from the plebeian. Among the privileges of the foreign pupils were frequent visits to the royal theater. And here was to Odo a source of unimagined joys. His superstitious dread of the stage, a sentiment he soon discovered that not even his mother's director shared, made his heart beat oppressively as he first set foot in the theater. It was a gala night, boxes and stalls were thronged, and the audience hall unfolded its glittering curves like some poisonous flower enveloping him in rich malignant fragrance. This impression was dispelled by the rising of the curtain on the scene of such clod-like loveliness as it would have been impossible to associate with the bugbear tales of Donnas, or with the coarse antics of the comedians at Chivasso. A temple girt with mysterious shade, lifting its colonnade above a sunlit harbor, and before the temple, vine-wreathed nymphs waving their thyrsi through the turns of a melodious dance. Such was the vision that caught up Odo, and swept him leagues away from the rouged and starred assemblage gathered in the boxes to gossip, flirt, eat ices and chocolates, and incidentally, in the pauses of their talk, to listen for a moment to the ravishing airs of Metastasia's Achilles in Syros. The distance between such performances, magic evocations of light and color and melody, and the gross buffoonery of the popular stage, still tainted with the obscenities of the old Commedia dell'arte, in a measure explains the different points from which at that period the stage was viewed in Italy. A period when in such cities as Milan, Venice, Turin, actors and singers were praised to the skies and loaded with wealth and favors, while the tatterdemalion players who set up their boards in the small towns at market time or on feast days were despised by the people and flung like carrion into unconsecrated graves. The impression Odo had gathered from Don Gervaso's talk was of the provincial stage in all its pothouse license. But here was a spectacle as lofty and harmonious as some great religious pageant. As the action developed and the beauty of the verse was borne to Odo on the light hurrying ripples of Caldara's music, he turned instinctively to share his pleasure with those about him. Canto Presto, in a new black coat and ruffles, was conspicuously taking snuff from the tortoiseshell box which the Countess's Cicisbeo had given him. But Odo saw that he took less pleasure in the spectacle than in the fact of accompanying the heir presumptive of Pianura to a gala performance at the Royal Theater, and the lads about them were for the most part engaged either with their own dress and appearance, or in exchanging greetings with the royal pages and the older students. A few of these sat near Odo, disdainfully superior in their fob chains and queues. And as the boy glanced about him, he met the fixed stare of one of the number, a tall youth seated at his elbow, and conspicuous, even in that modish company, for the exaggerated elegance of his dress. This young man, whose awkward bearing and long lava-hued face crowned with flamboyant hair contrasted oddly with his finical apparel, returned Odo's look with a gaze of eager comprehension. He too, it was clear, felt the thrill and wonder, or at least relived them in the younger lad's emotion, And from that moment Odo felt himself in mute communion with his neighbor. The quick movement of the story, the succession of devices by which the wily Ulysses lures Achilles to throw off his disguise, while Didymus strives to conceal his identity, the scenic beauties of the background, shifting from sculpture gallery to pleasance, from pleasance to banquet hall, the pomp and glitter of the royal train, the melting graces of Didymia and her maidens, seemed, in their multiple appeal, to develop in Odo new faculties of perception. It was his first initiation into Italian poetry, and the numbers, now broken, harsh and passionate, now flowing into liquid sweetness, were so blent with sound and color that he scarce knew through which sense they reached him. Didymia's strophes thrilled him like the singing girl's kiss, and at the young hero's cry, Malo, so chio sono a chill, emi sento a chill in sen, his fists tightened, and the blood hummed in his ears. In the scene of the banquet hall, where the followers of Ulysses lay before Lycomedes the offerings of the Greek chieftains, and, while the king and Didymia are marveling at the jewels and the Tyrian robes, Achilles, unmindful of his disguise, bursts out, Ah, chi vite finora armi piubel? At this supreme point Odo again turned to his neighbor. They exchanged another look, and at the close of the act the youth leaned forward, to ask with an air of condescension, colon, is this your first acquaintance with the divine Metastasia? I have never been in a playhouse before, said Odo reddening. The other smiled. Why, you are fortunate in having so worthy an introduction to the stage. Many of our operas are merely vulgar and ridiculous, but Metastasia is a great poet. Odo nodded a breathless assent. A great poet, his new acquaintance resumed, and handling a great theme. But do you not suffer from the silly songs that perpetually interrupt the flow of the verse? To me they are intolerable. Metastasia might have been a great tragic dramatist if Italy would have let him. But Italy does not want tragedies. She wishes to be sung to, danced to, made eyes at, flattered and amused. Give her anything, anything that shall help her to forget her own abasement. Paname circenses. That is always her cry. And who can wonder that her sovereigns and statesmen are willing to humor her, when even her poets stoop to play the mountebank for her diversion? The speaker, ruffling his locks with a hand that scattered the powder, turned on the brilliant audience his strange corrugated frown. Fools! Simpletons! He cried, not to see that in applauding the Achilles of Metastasia they are smiling at the allegory of their own abasement. What are the Italians of today, but men tricked out in women's finery, when they should be waiting full-armed to rally at the first signal of revolt? Oh, for the day when a poet shall arise who dares tell them the truth, not disguised in sentimental frippery, not ending in a maudlin reconciliation of love and glory, but the whole truth, naked, cold and fatal as a patriot's blade. A poet who dares show these bedizen courtiers they are no freer than the peasants they oppress, and tell the peasants they are entitled to the same privileges as their masters. He paused and drew back with a supercilious smile. But doubtless, sir, said he, I offend you in thus arraigning your sacred caste, for unless I mistake you belong to the race of demigods, the Titans whose downfall is at hand. He swept the boxes with a contemptuous eye. Little of this tirade was clear to Odo, but something in the speaker's tone moved him to answer, with a quick lifting of his head, colon, my name is Odo Valseca, of the Dukes of Pianura. When, fearing he had seemed to parade his birth before one evidently of inferior station, he at once added with a touch of shyness, colon, and you, sir, are perhaps a poet, since you speak so beautifully. At which, with a stare and a straightening of his long awkward body, the other haughtily returned, colon, a poet, sir. I am the Count Vittorio Alfieri of Asti. 1.9. The singular being with whom chance had thus brought him acquainted was to have a lasting influence on the formation of Odo's character. Vittorio Alfieri, then just concluding, at the age of 16, His desultory years of academic schooling was probably the most extraordinary youth in Charles Emmanuel's dominion. Of the future student, of the tragic poet who was to prepare the liberation of Italy by raising the political ideals of his generation, this moody boy with his craze for dress and horses, his pride of birth and contempt for his own class, his liberal theories and insolently aristocratic practice, must have given small promise to the most discerning observer. It seems indeed probable that none thought him worth observing, and that he passed among his townsmen merely as one of the most idle and extravagant young noblemen in a society where idleness and extravagance were held to be the natural attributes of the great. But in the growth of character, the light on the road to Damascus is apt to be preceded by faint premonitory gleams. And even in his frivolous days at the Academy, Elphiri carried a Virgil in his pocket, and wept and trembled over Ariosto's verse. It was the instant response of Odo's imagination that drew the two together. Odo, as one of the foreign pupils, was quartered in the same wing of the Academy with the students of Elphiri's class, and enjoyed an almost equal freedom. Thus, despite the difference of age, the lads found themselves allied by taste and circumstances. Among the youth of their class, they were perhaps the only two who already felt, however obscurely, the stirring of unborn ideals, the pressure of that tide of renovation that was to sweep them, on widely sundered currents, to the same uncharted deep. Alfieri, at any rate, represented to the younger lad the seer who held in his hands the keys of knowledge and beauty. Odo could never forget the youth who first lent him Annabelle Caro's Aeneid and Metastasia's opera libretti, Voltaire's Zaire and the comedies of Goldoni, while Alfieri perhaps found in his companion's sympathy with his own half-dormant tastes the first incentive to a nobler activity. Certain it is that, in the interchange of their daily comradeship, the elder gave his friend much that he was himself unconscious of possessing, and perhaps first saw reflected in Odo's more vivid sensibility and outline of the formless ideals coiled in the depths of his own sluggish nature. The difference in age, and the possession of an independent fortune, which the laws of Savoy had left Alfieri free to enjoy since his 15th year, gave him an obvious superiority over Odo. But if Alfieri's amusements separated him from his young friend, his tastes were always drawing them together, and Odo was happily of those who are more engaged in profiting by what comes their way than in pining for what escapes them. Much as he admired Alfieri, it was somehow impossible for the latter to condescend to him, and the equality of intercourse between the two was perhaps its chief attraction to a youth surfeited with adulation. Of the opportunities his new friendship brought him, none became in after years a pleasanter memory to Odo than his visits with Vittorio to the latter's uncle, the illustrious architect Count Benedetto Alfieri. This accomplished and amiable man, who had for many years devoted his talents to the king's service, was lodged in a palace adjoining the academy, and thither, one holiday afternoon, Vittorio conducted his young friend. Ignorant as Odo was of all the arts, he felt on the very threshold the new quality of his surroundings. These tall bare rooms, where busts and sarcophagi were ranged as in the twilight of a temple, diffused an influence that lowered the voice and hushed the step. In the semi-Parisian capital, where French architects designed the king's pleasure houses, and the nobility imported their boudoir panelings from Paris, and their damask hangings from Lyons, Benedetto Alfieri represented the old classic tradition, the tradition of the grand manner, which had held its own through all later variations of taste, running parallel with the barocchismo of the 17th century, and the effeminate caprices of the Rococo period. He had lived much in Rome, in the company of men like Winckelmann and Maffei, in that society where the revival of classical research was being forwarded by the liberality of princes and cardinals, and by the indefatigable zeal of the scholars in their pay. From this center of aesthetic reaction, Alfieri had returned to the Gallicized Turin, with its preference for the graceful and ingenious, rather than for the large, the noble, the restrained, bringing to bear on the taste of his native city the influence of a view. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.